Edvinka is an investment company exclusively dedicated to education. Edvinka is the fruit of a joint venture between Hamburg Perks, the growth investment firm behind PyTop and Cortex, and DLF Venture, a family-owned holding company affiliated to Verdinvest, who have invested in some of the most successful edtech companies in Asia, like Baijus. At Edvinka, our aim is to help edtech startups make large-scale impact. We are active investors who like to think global. We invest in early-stage companies that we grow alongside their founders. We offer follow-on funding and deploy permanent capital to address our long-term vision. Please visit our website on www.edvinka.com to find out more about our mission and get in touch on info@edvinka.com if you want to discuss your edtech business with us.
Here's a word from Class Central, the most popular search and review site for online courses. If you've ever gone on the hunt for a great online course from a top university, then you may already know about Class Central. Class Central is the most comprehensive search engine for MOOCs and online courses. The site lists over 10,000 courses and allows you to search by subject, university, keyword, and language of instruction. With tens of thousands of user reviews, you can use Class Central to help you decide if a course is right for you. And if you're into geeking out about online learning like I am, you'll love diving into Class Central's MOOC report. The MOOC report covers everything that's going on in the MOOC space, with news, analysis, and opinions about the fascinating world of online courses. A great place to start is with Class Central's in-depth analysis of the state of MOOCs in 2017. You can find a link in our show notes. Or if you're interested in finding out which courses are ranked the highest, check out Class Central's course rankings for the month and the year, or have a look at the top 50 MOOCs of all time. Hi everyone, and welcome to this week's podcast episode looking at Nordic excellence. If you're listening to this in real time, I hope you find this week's listening to be a happy break from your own particular brand of GDPR-related meltdown. This week, apart from sending out my GDPR email, I experienced the exquisite torture of a Les Mills spinning session at the London Velodrome, worked on the EdTech Podcast Festival, and excitedly confirmed the TS Podcast, the LSE IQ Podcast, and the JISC Podcast to our live podcast programme, and attended the EdTech Exchange launch drinks in their new JV Guys with BISA. It was great to catch up with familiar faces and meet new people at the Exchange evening. Here's George Burgess from the Exchange in London at this year's BET earlier in the year, explaining the joint venture and what it means for members and newbies.
So the EdTech Exchange, for those who don't know it, is an events and networking business really set up to support EdTech founders and entrepreneurs. It started as a supper club with a few of us meeting in a pub for dinner on a monthly basis. It grew organically from kind of eight of us first time round to now a couple hundred entrepreneurs who we work with every year. And with that kind of growth and organic growth of the entrepreneurial community has come a lot of invitations to partner with events like BET, like the London Book Fair, who we worked with last year, EdTech Europe, who we hosted a joint after party with this year. So we do a lot of different things, but basically our three goals are to connect, support, and represent the EdTech community and ecosystem, with obviously an emphasis on startups. So we've worked very closely with BISA over the last couple of years, as everyone in this sector does. And last year, we started to realize that the EdTech Exchange was becoming a lot of work for what was essentially my colleague full-time and myself part-time. One and a half of us were trying to put on 40 events a year, kind of working with 3,000 different people across all of those, one conference in December. It was a lot of work, and it was at that point becoming a bit strained. And I think those who were closest to it kind of realized that it was starting to lose some of the, you know, momentum that it had. So we looked at ways that we could kind of reinvigorate it. And we had some, you know, really in-depth conversations with Patrick at BISA and Caroline at BISA, and just felt there was a really good match there in terms of what both organizations were trying to achieve. We then looked at ways we might work more closely together. And basically now have entered the EdTech Exchange into a joint venture with them. So I am taking a step kind of backwards slightly and becoming chairman, and we'll be looking more at things long term, strategically, working with some of our kind of big sponsors to keep them on board and keep them happy. Patrick is taking on things kind of day to day operationally, and we'll be leveraging the team of, I think, 13 or 14 people at BISA to really invest in the EdTech Exchange and double down on everything it has to offer.
Thanks, George, and good luck to all the Exchange team with the new setup. What else? Well, I am recording this intro from a hotel in Lincoln in the UK, where I'm judging the Cool Initiatives Education Challenge tomorrow. Good luck to all of the finalists, and I hope to share the winner with you on the podcast next week. If you're an edu leader listening in from the UK, you might also check out Innovate My School's Lead Lives events, which focus on tools to reduce teacher workload and improve educational outcomes. Those are taking place all over the country and kick off from mid-June onwards. And so, on to this week's episode, which was recorded at South by Southwest EDU and features three conversations from across Norway, Finland and Sweden. First up, I just wanted to give all this week's guests a massive high five for their amazing accents. We have Saku Tueminen, founder at Hundred, then Hege Tollerud, CEO of Oslo EdTech Cluster, and finally Joel Hellemark, founder at Sana Labs. Listen in to hear about everything from where to hang out in Austin, what happens when you take an artificial intelligence course online age 13, and how to get over global education being either about holistic well-being or being great at PISA table rankings. A big thank you to our friends at Edvinca and Class Central for sponsoring this week's episode, and a big thanks to this week's lovely guests. Have a great week! So I'm here with Saku Tueminen, who's the founder of Hundred. And yeah, for anyone listening, I hugely encourage you to go and take a look at Hundred, because there's a fantastic wealth of educational innovation and really impactful initiatives on there from all around the world. So we'll go into that in a little bit, but perhaps just to get everyone to know what you're up to and who you are and what you're doing, you could give us a little introduction into that.
About 100.
Yeah, and just, you know, and how you went to about setting that up in the first place.
Okay, so I'd say that my passion, my background is in innovation. I've been working with innovation for more than 30 years. I've been working it in various industries, creative industries, media industries and so on. And as a hobby, kind of like, I've been helping Finnish schools, I've been discussing with Finnish teachers, doing a lot of pro bono and so on and so on. And obviously when there's a massive discussion about how schools should change globally and coming from Finland, then I'd say roughly about 5 years ago, I decided is that let's concentrate only on education, and let's sort of like try to identify how can innovations help schools change. So that was the starting point. And then Finland was turning 100 in 2017. And then we did a major project in Finland. We identified 100 Finnish innovations, packaged them and shared them. And we were getting so much positive feedback from all continents is that we decided that, okay, let's make 100 a global project.
So you have the 100 projects up there, which is essentially identifying some of the sort of change makers and what they're doing and hearing their story. And if I understand correctly, after my conversation with Summer, you're now going in sort of country by country or region by region?
Yeah. So what we are doing is that we are selecting 100 innovations annually. And we are looking for innovative, impactful, scalable innovations from all continents. We package them, we share them, and we help them spread. We are creating articles and so on and so on. So there's different kind of innovations from all over the world. Great stuff. And then in addition to this one, we are doing 100 spotlights. We are doing 100 spotlights which can be regional or based on a theme. And our first 100 Spotlight, which is a collection of 10 ideas, is happening in the state of Victoria in Australia. So together with local, with education changemakers, we are identifying what is happening in Victoria, we are packaging those, we are making videos out of each and every innovation, and we are sharing the message globally. We are also negotiating with different other areas in Catalonia, in Singapore, in Nairobi, and so on. And we could easily be making one in here in Austin, for example, selecting 10 innovations in here. We are also having 100 spotlights on theme. So it can be a spotlight on well-being or school food or school acoustics or anything. And actually, we are launching our first spotlight in here in Austin.
Okay,
and it's going to be a breaking news. So it's going to be a spotlight on sustainability, which we are doing together with Muse School from Los Angeles. So what we are doing is that we are identifying 10 great sustainability innovations. We are packaging them. We are making videos out of them. We are creating a report out of them. We are doing an event on them and help them spread.
And so when you say sustainability of ideas or literally sustainability of running the school?
It's a great idea. So what we are doing is sustainability, meaning how to improve the planet, how to leave, kind of like how to keep this planet safe and healthy and so on. So we are looking for two kinds of innovations. First of all, pedagogies, meaning is that how can you teach sustainable mindset and so on for kids. Then the second one would be sustainability regarding running a school.
So
we are looking for both of those. We are looking for big ideas, small ideas, digital ideas, analog ideas, but all of them have to be scalable.
So I might be a bit biased on that one, but my husband's the head of sustainability at the University of London.
Perfect.
So you can go and do a video with him.
He's
got a wonderful moustache. Very good for video.
Perfect.
And then I know you're not meant to have favourites, but do you have any from your huge treasure trove of videos and case studies? Do any kind of stand out in terms of the impact and just the storytelling of what they're doing?
Many. I could be listing 10, 15, 20, 20 and so on. But I'd say that one of the key insights, which is really fascinating, is that I'd say, for example, in Finland, there's quite a few people who would be willing to say is that the Finnish education system is brilliant, it's great, one of the best ones in the world and so on. And then people might say, I'm not saying, someone might say, is that the US education system might be having some problems and so on. So interestingly, does that mean that the best education innovations come from Finland? Does it mean that nothing great comes out of US? No. So interestingly, if you are trying to identify great education innovations, they can come from any part of the world. Also, at the moment in Africa, in Latin America, in India, in developing countries, emerging markets, they are having massive problems in education. But as a result of this, some of the innovations are extremely bold and they could be useful in every part of the world.
So
interesting thing in here is that there's massive amount of great things happening in education globally. The problem is that no one knows about them.
Mm-hmm.
So in a world which is a really, really, really global, for example, my daughter is 17 and her life is extremely global except when she goes to school.
So
in school, everything is local. There's no cooperation across borders and so on and so on. For example, they are studying China by the books. And in today's world, they could be doing projects daily or weekly and so on. And nothing is. And that's kind of like, I'd say, that's one of the key areas that we would love to change, making education, the world of K-12 education, a bit more global.
And so connecting, I mean, there's an interesting organization I came across called Beluga. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
So they essentially believe the same thing. They connect classrooms. So it's kind of like a slightly more sophisticated use of Skype, essentially just to connect classrooms to one another, which, you know, I think is such a simple idea, but, you know, gets people connected and gets them empathizing with one another.
Fully agree. And what we are having at the moment is we are looking for 100 ambassadors. So 100 ambassadors are passionate education people who love our mission, who want to be identifying great things that are happening in their own area, who are willing to spread the message and so forth. And we launched the program 7 weeks ago, and at the moment we are having ambassadors from 41 countries. So obviously there's a big need for this kind of cooperation.
Interesting indeed. And then, I mean, what are your thoughts on Finland? Because I know the PISA rankings are not the be all and end all, but if I understand correctly, there was a change of government, it's like change of tack in terms of how you go about things.
Well,
just because I'll repeat it tomorrow in my global edtech panel that I'm moderating, so you can give me all the good ideas and I'll steal them.
Well, first of all, like mentioned, innovation, creativity has been my passions for 30 years. I've been teaching innovation in a university and so on. And interestingly, when things are going quite well, that's not perfect for coming up with new ideas.
Right.
Because
yeah.
there is sort of like sense of content, meaning is that it's going okay, why not change and so on. And if you're trying to come up with something new, there's a lot of resistance. So that's kind of like one of the challenges. But then if I'm looking at the Finnish system, I'd say one of the beauties of the Finnish education system is the fact that we are always looking for excellence and equity. So for example, in here in South by Southwest, I've been listening to a few panels. And what is coming up in all the discussions, meaning is that we want to make our school better than others. We want our students to be above average and so on and so on. That kind of discussion doesn't exist in Finland because every school has to be great. And I think that that's beautiful. And that's exactly how you should build the ecosystem, education ecosystem. But what is the price of that one? Is that you might be lacking the bold ones who are doing odd things. Exactly.
Very interesting. You remind me, one of my first interviewees was Lowry from Leitner.
Yeah, yeah. And good friend of mine.
Yeah, he talked about this a lot, this idea of, you know, consistency and having equity. And in fact, after what you just said, I just had lunch with a lady who sends her children to school in New York, and she was saying exactly what you just said, that it's so competitive straight away. So you're already like, I have to be better than the next person and get to the next school and get to the next college. Yeah. So,
and it's interesting what is happening in, I'd say, the whole global education debate at the moment. It's so much about PISA and so on. Mm-hmm. So you have to be competitive in PISA and so on. Great. Then one of the big trends, for example, is holistic well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then the question is, which one is more important? Being great in PISA or the holistic well-being? And if they contradict, which one would you sacrifice? Because in many of the countries which are extremely successful in PISA, what is happening as a result is burnout, depression, and so on and so on. So that's kind of like the discussion we should also be having it here.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you believe in the innovation fallacy, this idea that we are actually not innovating enough in terms of creating new startups and that kind of thing? Have you heard about that one?
In education?
And just generally.
Well, first of all, I don't believe in innovation policies. I don't believe in innovation strategies and so on so much. What I believe in is sort of like brilliant people who are working on the front line, coming up with something that is valuable and spreading those. So I think that you cannot spread innovations, but you can accelerate the spreading of the ones that are already spreading. But what is the main challenge in education and scaling education innovations? I'd say is that if you are analyzing any industry, all the innovations spread bottom up, always. And education is extremely top-down, it's extremely local, it's full of silos, it's full of gatekeepers and so on. So I'd say that in the world of education, the main problem in the world of education is not the lack of innovations. What I've been saying quite often is that there's sayings that whatever happens in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas. And I'd say that the education is exactly like that, meaning that whatever happens in a classroom stays in a classroom. So I'd say that the key problem in the world of education is not the quality of innovations. It's the scaling part,
yes.
Which means how innovation scale is always bottom up by forerunner users and so on. And quite often when I'm discussing, for example, our innovations in 100, and for example, in the morning I'm discussing with 500 teachers and I'm saying that this is what we do. They are all excited, meaning that this is fantastic. I could easily be using this in my classroom and so on and so on. Then in the afternoon, I might be discussing with district leaders. And they are quite often saying that, yes, but this would never, ever work in our area. Teachers don't like this kind of things and so on. So, and then I try to say that actually I was discussing with them this morning and they are excited and so on. But this is exactly the same. If you, for example, let's take Uber, even though education and Uber are totally different.
Yeah.
But let's take Uber. If you would be kind of like Uber, why Uber is spreading? because customers love it. They find it useful. But if the way to make Uber spread would be always through ministries, so you would have to sell the idea for Uber to the Ministry of Transportation, it would be so easy to be against that one. Because they would say that, yes, but customers would never ever trust Lanson. And this is kind of like what is happening in education, because I think that teachers might be actually surprisingly open for some great innovations, but there is no trust in the ecosystem. And this is something which probably have to be changed.
What are you currently reading?
Book-wise.
Yeah.
I love reading. So
I can imagine. Yeah.
Actually,
we have a little book club, so I'd like you to share.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. I'm actually writing a book about decision making and decision making / intuition, and trying to create my model. So most of the books I've been reading lately have been somehow based on that one. So intuition, thinking skills, and so on. But for example, on the weekend I was reading a book on communication by Buddhist monk called Thich Nhat Hanh.
Okay.
And it's marvelous, it's brilliant. It's kind of like, it's comparing communication with nutrition. So it's kind of like you can be... Exactly, meaning is that you can be either eating healthy or unhealthy. And if you're eating healthy, it's giving you energy and so on and so on. And when about your communication, it can be either healthy or unhealthy. And kind of like that's the essence of the book. Beautiful one.
Very interesting. Okay. So is education about doing what you can or changing the whole system? So I think there's a lot of chat about tinkering around the edges with things like EdTech.
Well, I think that this is a crucial question. And whenever I go to education seminars and I'm listening to the panels, for example, the question that I'm lacking most is the really basic question, meaning what is the purpose of education in general? And when I've been meeting schools, principals, what teachers and so on, I quite often start with that discussion. So meaning is that before going to any innovations or anything, let's define what is the purpose of education. And if you're asking me, I'd say that the purpose is to help every kid flourish in life no matter what happens. So not today, but in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, and so on and so on. So then one of the key things education should be providing would be a passion for learning new things, and so on. So I'd say that whenever we are discussing about innovations or making schools change or whatever, we should always start with this one. Does this fact that we are trying to do help every kid flourish in life no matter what happens? And for example, when we are discussing about EdTech, it should always start with this fundamental thought. Is it great from the kid's point of view, from the pedagogical point of view? And I think that kind of discussion is quite often lacking.
Yeah, I think that we're having that conversation a lot in the UK at the moment. And here's another interesting one on the innovation side. So this is something I see between, you know, VCs and the idea, like you said, of education and teaching and learning being quite localized. So, you know, is scale inconsistent with relevant education, so that being localized?
I might be naive, but I'm an idealist on at heart. But I'd say that nothing scales unless teachers love it. So I think that kind of like teachers have to love something in order to make it spread. But I'd say that one of the key problems at the moment is that the world is full of great education innovations that teachers love and that have massive potential to spread to every country of the world. Then there are EdTech companies who are having massive resources and organization helping to spread. But quite often the resources and know-how and the quality of the innovation, they don't meet.
They don't match,
Exactly. So the best education innovations are not always the one who have organization, funding model, or whatever to help them spread. And I think that this is something that should change. So we have to find a way to identify what are the education innovations that are already spreading, that teachers love, and so on. And we should concentrate on helping those spread. Because among our 100 innovations, there's dozens of innovations that are already in 10 plus countries. And they are fantastic innovations which could work in practically every school of the world.
So getting the investment and the networks to them.
Exactly. And some of them are non-profits. And I think that foundations, non-profits or whatever, they should identify, and we are more than happy to help them and do it together with them, seeing that this is an amazing innovation. It's already in 10 plus countries. It has all the potential to scale. Let's help those. So instead of coming up with new things all the time, let's identify what is already out there, what is great, what is impactful, and help those spread.
And who are you excited about meeting here during your time in Austin? And I'm sure you already know a whole bunch of people already out here, but what are you spending your time here doing?
I'm giving a speech here, but we are also doing a workshop with US teachers. Always fascinating to really discuss with teachers about implementing innovations, because innovations have a slight image problem with teachers, for example. So teachers, they love great ideas that are solving a problem, but they hate innovations.
Yeah, so we have a problem with these words like disrupt, exactly. And it's not helpful. Yeah,
exactly. So I'm mostly excited about discussing with teachers from public schools and so on, and really to understand the mindset of them and so on and so on. So that's for me the key thing in here.
And when your book comes out, what's it going to be called so we can look out for it?
The book will be in Finnish, okay. And the Finnish name will be UA, which means kind of like yes, no, but it's a play with the words. But it's a life-changing model. And I promise anybody who will be reading that book, his or her life will be changed forever.
And so it's not just for educators? It's not more conceptual?
It's not for educators. It's kind of like identifying on how to make the change happen and so on. But I was discussing with key people, for example, in IDEO, working with education.
So that's Sandy Spiker.
Sandy, exactly. Yeah. I was discussing with Sandy and what Sandy was saying is that the model I was proposing is kind of like explaining huge percentage of the key problems education systems globally are facing.
Okay, and when's that out?
The book is out next fall in October.
And in the bookshops or?
It's going to be in Finnish bookshops and then hopefully next year in English as well.
In translation, yeah, okay. And then finally, how can people contact you? So how can they connect with what you're doing?
What they should do is that they should go to the website 100.org,
yep.
And then there's 100 innovations, there's open, any innovator can be releasing their, using our platform to pitch their own ideas for free. They can browse, that's they can go through 100 innovations from all continents. If they want to get more information, they can approach either us or the innovator directly. If someone wants to organize a spotlight on their area, for example, they can contact us and so on and so on. If there's a school who wants to be, who's excited about global education innovations, they can be contacting us and we can be sending them newsletters about innovations monthly. And we are also organizing them so that any principal, anywhere, any teacher, any principal, anywhere in the world can be contacting us and asking questions. For example, we are looking for design thinking innovations or assessment innovations and so on. And we are giving them information for free.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you, Saku, very much.
Thanks for the interview.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's the very start of South by Southwest EDU 2018. And I'm going to have a shot at pronouncing your name correctly. So is it Hege?
Hege, yes.
Oh, brilliant. Tollerud, the CEO of Oslo EdTech Cluster, is here with me. So welcome.
Thank you very much.
So you're kind of like an old friend of the EdTech podcast. I think we bumped into each other first here last year and got to know each other a little bit and over time. And so, yeah, I guess for anyone listening in, first of all, what's Oslo EdTech Cluster and what do you do? And tell us a little bit about yourself and your day-to-day life as well.
Yeah, sure. So the Oslo EdTech Cluster is a business network or a cluster of companies and providers of learning technology in Norway. So the cluster is set up to basically create sort of a brand and help the Norwegian EdTech industry grow. So basically what we do is like a number of different types of activities to get the actual industry together so that they can come together and share like different experiences, knowledge, network even. So they get together and then they can discuss what types of different challenges or what have they done right and wrong, so that they don't all have to make the same mistakes and that they can all come and learn from each other, which is mainly like what we're doing on a national level. But obviously we're also here to help the Norwegian industry go out in the world and sort of help internationalize and also do like profiling, so kind of highlight what kind of good products and services that we've got coming out of Norway.
And so are you speaking here this week?
I'm not speaking, no. I'm just talking a lot to people.
Having a lot of meetings. And so which types of people are you meeting at here and kind of what's your main focus?
It's a lot about meeting people in the industry. So I'm like, for example, meeting with ISTI because we're looking at doing actually a Nordic pavilion, because we're also doing like quite a lot of Nordic collaboration in the edtech industry. So meeting with them to kind of see how can we work together moving forward, and doing actually a big presence at ISTI in Chicago. I'm also meeting with a lot of people like from the city of Austin, because we've been coming here for years now. And
yeah,
it's always useful to help like into the US market. We have one of our members, Kahoot, is based here in Austin, so it's always really helpful for our other members that are coming over for this to meet with them and see how does it work in the market here.
In fact, I met Danielle from Kahoot at the Capital Factory yesterday, so that was I think I'd interacted with her avatar quite a lot on Twitter, and then so when I met her in real life it kind of threw me. But I guess on that note, so, you know, Norway is quite responsible for some huge edtech companies like Kahoot, as you mentioned. And then more recently, I met Hold, who have just launched, which I suppose essentially is an app to reward students for not being distracted by their phone and then being rewarded by a marketplace of brands and offers, depending on how long they, you know, actually study for. Are there any other kind of edtech companies that you're seeing coming through that you would recommend people look out for as well?
Oh, that's a hard question to kind of pull out some of, like, we've got like 55 members altogether.
Yeah.
But I think one that is doing quite a lot of big contracts now internationally is Inspera, who are doing digital assessment. So they've just signed contracts with Cambridge Assessment and Oxford. So they're like kind of expanding quite fast and big in the world actually. So that's an exciting one. I suppose it's like a bit more on the administrative side because it's assessment. We also have Dragonbox. You might have heard of their, it's an app for numbers and learning algebra. So it's like a game-based thing, but they're also kind of expanding now. So they started off as a game, as an app, but now working with schools and also doing like the whole curriculum in Norway to start with, but hopefully they'll also go. And we have a similar one for reading called Poyo, which is a reading app.
Okay.
So it's kind of little animals representing the different letters, and then you play it without realizing that you're actually learning, and then suddenly you can read in.
So for that one, can you access that without being a school, or you can just download that as direct to consumer?
Yeah, it's a B2C.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. Yeah.
So yeah, so it's a lot of exciting stuff going on.
And then how about kind of on the policy side of things? So at the moment, you know, during BET Week, we were just talking about that, but there was a lot of interest in what the new Secretary of State for Education had to say about the potential of technology. I just wondered in Norway currently what the sort of educational policy side of things looks like. And also, you know, perhaps you could explain to some of our listeners what the setup is like in terms of connecting innovation with the school system. So whether it's more private schools, state schools, there's that kind of idea of Norway always being very flush with money. So
yeah, I think it's a lot of the challenges are the same in terms of budget. And it's, I think one of the main challenges is that there is no central policy. So it's all down to like almost down to each teacher level. Okay. Like at some places there's some budget within the teacher, and then a little bit in the school, and then a little bit in the school owner, which are the municipalities. So it's kind of really a hard one to crack. You can't just go like, oh, I'll get that market, because it's kind of so fragmented.
Yes.
Having said that, I think we're quite good at sort of starting now to adapt, and I can really see that it's changing a little bit faster than it used to. But it still takes a long time. We don't have a lot of private schools. So at least the public schools are getting there, but it's, I mean, for all of us working within the educational technology, it's too slow.
And what are the kind of main struggles for teachers or for school leaders or higher education leaders in terms of what services they need? Is it the same in terms of people talking a lot about STEAM and STEM, or are there other sort of specific challenges to Norway?
I think the challenges are probably the same as everywhere else. But I think for the teachers, it's all about, one thing is budget, but it's also time. So it's like kind of finding your way and navigating that jungle of so many different kind of offers that are out there for free and paid. So what we see from the sort of the user side of things is like they're coming to us and saying like, how do we know, what's the evidence, how do we know what's good, how can we kind of navigate this landscape, because we're just being kind of bombarded so much with different types of edtech
services. I mean, I think, guess that's where we are certainly, is that there are lots of services popping up to try and validate, you know, which is useful tool essentially for a certain specific context. I don't know, are you finding services like that pop up, or is that something that also EdTech is trying to provide? Or
you can definitely tell that people are trying to sort of crack it and see like, oh, should we set up a platform, and how do, like, we actually like kind of serve that need, and I don't think it's like a very simple answer to it.
No.
What we're doing at the Oslo EdTech Cluster is we're actually working quite closely with, for example, the City of Oslo, which is like the biggest school owner in Norway.
Yeah.
And to do sort of regular meeting places where they're inviting all their employees, like all the teachers, all the school leaders, and then we set up like, so that we can get them like a sort of valid intro to different types of products and services.
Yeah.
So hopefully that will at least help navigate a little bit. So we're doing like a regular, like maybe once or twice a month now, which is really good. And then obviously that concept can be kind of just copied and taken everywhere. So we've done a few in other parts of Norway as well.
And are there particular sort of schools or universities or indeed individuals that are seen within Norway to be really innovative? Are there certain examples of schools that you can think of?
Yeah, there are definitely like single schools, because it's all down to actually making a decision. I think it's all about the mindset, and it's about changing the whole culture of how you spend your budgets, because it is down to the school leader whether they want to spend it on books. I'm not saying that we're taking away books completely, but you can actually choose. So we have some schools that are totally digital and everyone's got their own devices and hardly any books. They have a library, but that's it. No one has like their own books. So we have a few schools like that. We also have some municipalities are also like leading the way, so kind of making a decision on a bit more central than school to school. So we definitely have some. I'm very optimistic. I think it's happening, but it's just
like
taking
to name
too long.
Drop?
I mean, the City of Oslo is good and important as well, because they're so big. But again, it's down to the single schools. Bærum, which is like a municipality just outside Oslo, they've done it on a municipality level. Just decided that we're all digital now.
Yeah. Because I was chatting to someone from the Swedish EdTech kind of group during BET, and they were sort of saying that I think there's a move to try and have everyone sort of on one-to-one devices by, is it 2020? Which seemed fairly radical. And then I suppose it's, you know, then measuring the impact of that.
Yeah, exactly. Because a lot of people are skeptical, which I suppose healthy skepticism is good.
It's been
a
lot of money piled in, isn't there? Yeah. So, you know,
I think it's very important to not just go like, yeah, we're doing one-to-one, but like putting sort of the knowledge and the pedagogy into it as well. Because I think people don't really know, or a lot of people don't know enough about how to actually use these devices.
Yeah.
So it's important to just don't go and think that, yeah, if everyone's got their own device, that's
then we're
it.
Sorted, yeah.
So, and I think that's been kind of a problem in the past. I think we've moved on from that now, hopefully. But it's been like a bit of a problem, which has kind of been working against us in the EdTech industry.
I saw a funny tweet on the way in on the bus, and someone put, I've got a radical, like, evidence-based idea for South by Southwest EDU. Remove all the tech, remove all the classrooms, and go outside and play.
Yeah, exactly.
Made me chuckle anyway. Exactly. So you were saying that you were here in the summer.
Yeah.
And you've been here a few times. So do you have your kind of favourite haunts in Austin yet? The places that you like to go when you come and visit?
That's a good question. What I do love is like going around the lake in the morning just to start the day off there. It's brilliant.
So is that up by, is it Zilker Park?
No, just here in town, like by the Ladybird Lake. So literally like two blocks away.
I didn't know that one.
So and it's loads of people. It's a path all the way around. So you can, and you can choose like how far you actually want to go because it's bridges, obviously.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's the best start to the day ever. And then I quite like for going out, having drinks, it's nice on the like quite far east on 6th. Not on the dirty 6th in town. It's not so nice. But yeah, far east on 6th and also south.
Okay. Yeah. That's where all the antique shops are, is it? And that, this side, yeah.
Yeah, probably on the way there, yeah.
Okay. What books are you currently reading, if any? Are there any books that like have either influenced you, and they don't have to be to do with ed tech, but any books, resources, people that you follow on Twitter that you like to share with our listeners?
That's a hard one. Currently I'm just reading like a Norwegian book that wouldn't say much. I've just finished, I love Paul Auster, so I've just finished the 4-3-2-1, which is a massive book, so I couldn't bring it.
And what's that about?
It's actually four separate stories of a boy growing up in New York, in Jersey, and it's like the same sort of frames around him, but like the story takes different turns in each of the different stories. So you have to kind of, so you go like one story and then it's another story and then it's another story and then you go back and then it's the first one again, and then he kind of grows up, and it's just really, and you just have to be kind of paying attention because it's suddenly like, oh, so what life was that in?
Well, any final messages for people listening in? How can people connect with what you're doing? Or,
well, obviously, we can find us on osloedtech.no. And I think what I've learned, and I'm learning every day, I think, is just to be working together, partnerships, like be open, just share. I mean, the whole philosophy of a cluster is kind of sharing.
Sharing ideas.
And even though it's like within the cluster, it's competition, but it's kind of healthy and you should be able to stomach that. And I think just sharing and partnering, like we're also doing like a really good Nordic collaboration and partnership at the moment. So so we've found that really valuable, especially when we're going like further away. Like, for example, in the summer, we're going to Isti and we're going to do like a Nordic pavilion.
That's fantastic.
So, so I think like partnerships, like going out, meeting people, and just because I think what we all want to achieve at the end of the day is better learning. So the best way to do that is kind of work together on achieving it.
Fantastic. Well, on that note, everyone should, who's listening in, go and connect with Oslo EdTech. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
So today's Wednesday at South by Southwest EDU, and I'm here today with Joel Hellemark from Asana Labs out of Sweden.
Exactly, Stockholm, Sweden.
And so Joel, welcome to the EdTech podcast.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, and what you're doing here at South by Southwest EDU as well, please?
Of course, yeah. So we're an artificial intelligence company based out of Stockholm, Sweden, which is focusing on personalizing educational content. So we're a team of researchers and engineers who have backgrounds applying artificial intelligence to various other fields. So anything from medicine at AstraZeneca to music recommendations at Spotify. And now we're super passionate about bringing cutting edge artificial intelligence and recent breakthroughs within deep learning to all of the world's educational products. So we're here at South by Southwest meeting the large publishers, the small ed tech companies, all of the products that could make use of personalization to drive user engagement as well as learning efficacy.
And so quite well promoted that you're in your younger years. So how did you get into this space and, you know, found this company and go down that path as well?
Yeah, so actually I went into programming when I was 13. So I found these online Stanford courses in programming in C, and got really into producing iPhone applications and then subsequently more and more artificial intelligence. So Andrew Ng, a professor at Stanford, started publishing his deep learning courses online, which I started taking, and got more and more inspired about the potential of it. So every few decades, you have these sort of underlying technologies which come about. And I really think artificial intelligence is one of those, which will enable breakthroughs in every single industry. And I thought one of the industries where it could have the greatest impact is within education. So there's been a lot of interesting studies published on the effectiveness of personalized education. But to date, we haven't really been able to do it at scale. So what I started researching was, could we apply deep learning to make personalized education much more scalable and effective, and founded the company on that thesis, actually my last year in high school. So yeah, I was been programming since pretty much I was a kid, and founded the Sana Labs fairly early on as well.
This is quite interesting, because my next guest is the CEO of edX, so another online learning platform. So having been the beneficiary of online learning, what kind of question would you ask him if you had the chance?
So I think the use case, which I just mentioned. So historically, what you've done is that you've taken these courses, the exact same courses, and made them available online. But of course, I had a lot of gaps in my maths knowledge. I was like 13, 14, and I was taking university courses. So how do you build the products so they can appropriately adapt to any type of learner with any type of prerequisites? And I think that's super interesting now as a next step, where they have to produce a lot more content in order to accommodate for this varying user groups within their products. And also, I'd be keen to understand more how they think of personalization within their products, because students have so many different knowledge levels when they come into edX. So how do they plan to account for that?
Very interesting. Yeah, so you can adapt to whoever's on there. And what kind of people have you been meeting with this week? I mean, you mentioned the publishing companies and so on. With Sana Labs, you know, do you have enough data that it has that deep learning or machine learning sophistication yet? Or is that something that you want to connect with people and then you can build out with your expertise kind of thing?
No, so we already have data sets of over 100 million students. So we have these quite immense data sets, which allows us to uncover a whole new truths about how humans learn. We've investigated what drives engagement, found patterns such as when students have around 70% probability of getting questions correctly, that's when they're the most engaged. As soon as the content becomes either too hard or too easy, that's when the engagement decreases.
And how did you go about getting such enormous data sets?
By partnering with all of these large publishers and ed tech companies. So they're all, I think, in general, the status quo is that every single education company is looking at personalization and adaptivity, and they don't really have the resources to develop all of the infrastructure, all of the algorithms that are required in order to really implement personalization. So they're really keen to partner in providing that for their users.
It's a really interesting one though, isn't it? Because I mean, this morning I was just reading an EdSurge article on this exact topic, and yeah, it was about Jose Ferreira sort of leaving and the new management coming in, and you know, how Pearson had at one point, you know, thought, great, we're going to work with them. And now they're kind of stepping back a bit.
Yeah.
And perhaps, you know, thinking about doing that in-house. So yeah, you're still seeing, though, the trend to work with external partners as opposed to publishers thinking we can do it ourselves.
Yeah, very much so. I think this first wave of adaptive learning was more promises than actual results. And it could take up to 18 months to implement these kinds of systems. However, what we now enable with deep learning is that you can have these systems up and running in 2 weeks. And you have these much more data-driven approaches where they're directly correlated to actual learning outcomes. We have an objective function which we optimize for, and the algorithm sort of iteratively improves to reach that objective function. So I think partially once you can drive costs, since the implementation is much quicker, get better results and have the implementation in 2 weeks, it's a whole nother game. And that's what we're seeing now when we're speaking to these companies. So companies which might traditionally have built it in-house are much more keen to focus on their core, what they really do well, which is the user experience and the content. And allow other companies like ours, where essentially the whole team is machine learning engineers, to focus on the personalization.
And how much is GDPR making you kind of stay up at night if you're dealing with these huge data sets and within a European context?
Yeah, we're obviously thinking a lot about it. And it's good that we're getting these kinds of restrictions in Europe, because that allows us to have a good setup once we go into to the US. I think we receive mostly anonymized data. There are some problems with the definition of anonymized data. You can't be able to sort of reverse engineer that and track back the users. But I think we, to a very large degree, have already solved it. But of course, this is something that's very critical for us to keep in mind.
And did you go to university as well?
No, I started my first year, but as mentioned, I founded Sana my last year in high school, and it has kept me quite busy since.
Yeah. That's amazing. And so how did you go about building your team? So you obviously had this work and, you know, had this kind of idea of using AI for positive means.
Yeah.
How did you then aggregate your team and kind of go from there?
Yeah, so like my core thesis is in especially recruiting engineers, is that the best engineers are orders of magnitude better than sort of the mid segment. So the output could be anything from 20 to 50x that of a mid segment engineer. So we've always been very keen to attract the very best. And what we see is that we attract a lot of engineers from that have built recommendation systems at YouTube and Spotify, and in that might not be seen as so much of a meaningful application. So partially we can attract the very best people on a meaningful application, and that we can actually improve student learning outcomes by improving these algorithms. And also we really apply the state of the art within machine learning, and they're keen to be working on the cutting edge technology. So to a very large degree, we've just reached out to the very best engineers with our mission, our technology, and they've been keen to meet and eventually join the team.
And how about the funding side of things?
So we've raised $1 million from a host of private investors, so partners at one of Europe's leading venture funds, Atomico, Spotify's previous chief marketing officer, Sophia Benz, and a set of other local investors.
You're obviously moving incredibly fast. You ditch university, just get on with Sana Labs. You know, what can we expect over the next year? There are, as you mentioned, like adaptive learning platforms, and AI in education is something that is almost becoming expected of every edtech company out there. What can we expect from Sana Labs in terms of the next year and what you may be announcing or working on as well?
Yeah, so I might actually go to university. It's not something I've completely ditched. I'm in fact very keen to do so. What you can expect from Sana over the coming years is a lot of case studies. So we're currently aiming to deliver on the promises that a lot of these previous companies have set up, and also scale. So we're discussing partnerships with almost every single one of the world's largest education companies, and looking to implement over the coming year. So a lot of case studies and also scale our platform to hundreds of millions of students to really provide the benefits of personalized education for every student globally.
And who inspires you? So we mentioned Andrew Ng before in your course there. Are there any other people that have inspired you to kind of take the path that you have? And that doesn't have to be a kind of educational person, but someone that's kind of developed your thinking, and whether you have either an individual or any other books that you've read that you go back to and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think I'm very inspired, and I sort of idolize these polymaths, which are not necessarily experts within one single domain, but their expertise lies in combining insights from different domains. So you had someone like Edwin Land, who was not sort of an expert chemist just, but an expert businessman. And his expertise led in combining the cutting-edge research with the business applications of that. And obviously Steve Jobs did the same with combining the state-of-the-art technology and the design to make that technology really personal and relevant for anyone. So I idolize, and I'm a big fan of sort of interdisciplinary work where you take the cutting edge research and make it personal and relevant for the whole world. So that's what I'm super passionate about and what has really inspired my work in taking the best research and making it available for everyone.
Wonderful. And then if people want to find out how they can connect with you, are you on Twitter or what's the best way for them to kind of follow up?
Yeah, exactly. Joel Hellermark at Twitter, Hellermark at twitter.com.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
This week's episode. If you enjoy the EdTech podcast, please consider taking a look at our Patreon site and signing up for just $1 a month. I hope that you get more value than that from each listen, and if enough of you do it, it will be a wonderful thing. If that's not your cup of tea, but you love giving reviews, feel free to post a review on iTunes or Spotify or share the podcast with an EdTech or Edu friend. That's all for now. We will be back soon with more from South by Southwest EDU and around the world. Bye-bye.